Shiny Stockings and Wet T-Shirts. Written and read by Lisa Patou.
Flippin' heck. What's a girl got to do to get a dance round here tonight? I tell you, the women here tonight are like lionesses on heat. I'm not joking. If you're not quick enough, all you're left with is the toothless old grey ones that smell of blackcurrant squash. And the things some women will do to get a dance. That girl over there. Thinks she dances like Sid Charisse. More like Sid Little. She's literally going round the dance floor, clubbing guys over the head and dragging them off their partners before the end of the song. And the guys just expect women to throw themselves at them these days. Some of them will only ask you to dance if you shag. And I'm sorry, I'm just not into that. Guys seem to like it, though. American girls are the worst. Going up to all the men so blatant. Hey, do you want a shag? And the guys are like,
okay then.
Typical men. The brains are in the dance shoes. Look at her over there. Guys can't get enough of her. Don't know why all she does is shag. Any place, any time, anywhere, any music. She's no shame. I mean, how can you shag to Shiny Stockings? Oh, it's so embarrassing. Give swingers a bad name. Personally, I wouldn't be seen dead doing that on the dance floor, me. But just because it's a bit different, as soon as anyone starts that sort of thing, everyone just stops and watches. And they love it. But they're just exhibitionists, if you ask me, lapping up the attention. Oh, God. Him over there. Oh, I hope he doesn't ask me to dance. I danced with him once, but never again. Told me my arms were all floppy. Ooh, you've got floppy arms, he said. I need more tension. Well, you obviously know all about floppy, I said, Mr. Floppy. But it is tension you want, I can do tension. Anyway, he dislocated his arm on a Texas Tommy. It was in traction for weeks. You should have seen everyone duck whenever he swung out. Of course you're okay if you got down like a proper Lindy Hopper. But he knocked a few Soroka's heads off, though. Serves him right, though, if you ask me. He's a nice dancer, actually. You want to ask him. Ever so sweaty, but you can get a good connection in the fingertips, actually. You don't want to do a barbeau with him now. Unless, of course, that is you want people to ask you why you've taken a shower in your clothes. He is gorgeous, though, isn't he? Ever such a good lead. I stole one of his wet T-shirts once. Took it home and hung it on the wall in a picture frame. I'll never wash it. Say my Lindy prayers to it every night. Pray for a good lead. The girls are queuing up to do his laundry, but he won't let just anyone near his T-shirts. Oh no, Mr. Bounce Features is here. Oh, I hope he hasn't seen me. I will only want to sort out my Lindy turn. He spent 6 months trying to teach me to bounce. Come on, bounce! Start bouncing! He'd say, you're not bouncing. I'm not leading any flash moves until you start bouncing. I don't want to bounce. I really don't mind not bouncing. I said, I just don't think I'm a bouncy person. Fortunately, though, he started his own classes not long after, so he won't try and teach you on the social floor unless you pay him now. That does look like an alarmingly big wad of flies he's got there, though. He asked me on a date once, offered to buy me a drink. I said, yes, please. I'd like a Bacardi and Coke, please. He said, no way. You can have orange or lime cordial in your tap water or nothing. And then he walked off, leaving me to pay. Oh, he's a dreadful lead. You don't know. You've never danced with him. He thinks he's the bee's knees, but he doesn't swing. Anyway, I'm going to have a walk around and see if I can find anyone to dance with over there. If you do find any good leads, send them over my way. Unless he smells of garlic or minces when he dances, you can keep them for yourself. See you later.
The House Is Not the Same Since You Left, by Henry Normal, read by Jill Munro.
The house is not the same since you left. The cooker is angry. It blames me. The TV tries desperately to stay busy, but occasionally I catch it staring out of the window. The washing up's feeling sorry for itself again. It just sits there saying, what's the point? What's the point? The curtains count the days. Nothing in the house will talk to me. I think your armchair's dead. The kettle tried to comfort me at first, but you know what its attention span's like. I've not told the plants yet. They still think you're on holiday. The bathroom misses you. I hardly see it these days. It still can't believe you didn't take it with you. The bedroom won't even look at me. Since you left, it keeps its eyes closed. All it wants to do is sleep, remembering better times, trying to lose itself in dreams. It seems like it's taken the easy way out. But at night, I hear the pillows weeping into the sheets.
An extract from Cranford by Elizabeth Gaskell. Read by Teresa Sunich.
In the first place, Cranford is in possession of the Amazons. All the holders of the houses above a certain rent are women. If a married couple comes to settle in the town, somehow the gentleman disappears. It is as if he either is frightened to death by being the only man in the Cranford evening parties, or he is accounted for by being with his regiment, his ship, or closely engaged in business all week in the great neighbouring commercial town of Drumble, distant only 20 miles on the railroad. In short, whatever does become of a gentleman, they are not at Cranford. What could they do if they were there? The surgeon has his round of 30 miles and sleeps at Cranford. But everyone cannot be a surgeon. For keeping the trim gardens full of choice flowers without a weed to speck, for frightening away little boys who look wistfully at the said flowers through the railings, for rushing out at the geese that occasionally venture into the garden if the gates are left open, for deciding all questions of literature or politics without troubling themselves with unnecessary reasons, for obtaining clear and correct knowledge of everybody's affairs in the parish, for keeping their neat maid servants in admirable order, for kindness, somewhat dictatorial, and the real tender good offices to each other whenever they are in distress. The ladies of Cranford are quite sufficient. A man, as one of them observed to me, is so in the way in the hut. Although the ladies of Cranford know all each other's proceedings, they are exceedingly indifferent to each other's opinions. Indeed, as each has her own individuality, not to say eccentricity, nothing is so easy as a verbal retaliation. But somehow, goodwill reigns amongst them to a considerable degree. The Cranford ladies have only an occasional little quarrel, spirited in a few peppery words and jerks of the head, just enough to prevent the even tenor of their lives from becoming too flat. Their dress is very independent of fashion, as they observe. What does it signify how we dress in Cranford, where everybody knows us? And if they go from home, their reason is equally cogent. What does it signify how we dress here, where nobody knows us? The materials of their clothes are, in general, good and plain, and most of them are nearly as scrupulous as Miss Tyler, of cleanly memory. But I will answer for it, the last tight and scanty petticoat in wear in England, was seen in Cranford, and seen without a smile.
Apartment 3A by Jeff Daniels, read by Marcia Leckie.
I came home. I was early, and there he was. Or there, should I say, was his bare ass, because that's all I could see. That and her legs wrapped around his back. Actually, they were way up around his neck. And I remember thinking, what's Richard doing fucking a gymnast on my grandmother's dining room table? I actually stood there, marvelling at their flexibility. Mary Lou saw me first. Oh my God, Richard! Richard! He turns, he sees. Lots of silence, lots of fumbling around for clothing no one can find. He tries to apologise. He tries to make it my fault. He tries to get me to slap him, hit him, hate him. All I want to do is check the condition of my grandmother's table. She leaves. I go into the kitchen. I come back out with some furniture polish and I make what I thought was the love of my fucking life polish that table until it shines. The next morning I put it out on the street and it's gone in 30 minutes, as is he. Crossfade 2 weeks later. I'm in the corner market. Richard walks in with her. I say, Richard. He says, Annie. I say, what are you doing here? He says, just picking up a few things. I can't resist. You mean besides her? She calls me a bitch, heads turn, the kid behind the counter looks up. I turn to Richard and I say, why? All I want is a reason why. And he turns to me and he says, because you care too much in a world that doesn't give a shit anymore. And I stand there, in the middle of that market, and for the first time in my life, I can't think of a thing to say. So I run, out of my market, out of my neighbourhood, out of my life as I know it. I end up at a local U-Haul outlet where I rent a truck for the first time in my life. I pack up everything I own and I drive around the city in circles until I come upon this sign, apartment for rent, which I do, after being told how lucky I am.
An extract from The Art of Travel by Alain de Botton, read by Ethel Mercedes.
On disembarking at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport, I'm struck, only a few steps inside the terminal, by the appearance of a sign hanging from the ceiling which announces the way to the arrivals hall, the exit and the transfer desks. It's a bright yellow sign, 1 metre high and 2 metres across, simple in design, a plastic fascia in an illuminated aluminium box, suspended on steel struts from a ceiling webbed with cables and air conditioning ducts. Despite its simplicity, even its mundanity, the sign delights me, a delight for which the adjective exotic, though unusual, seems apt. The exoticism is located in particular areas, in the double A of the Ankomst, in the neighbourliness of the U and the I in the Utgang, and in the use of English subtitles. If the sign provokes in me genuine pleasure, it is in part because it offers the first conclusive evidence of my having arrived elsewhere. It's a symbol of being abroad. Although it may not seem distinctive to the casual eye, such a sign would never exist in precisely this form in my own country. There it would be less yellow. The typeface would be softer and more nostalgic. There would, out of greater indifference to the confusion of foreigners, be no subtitles, and the language would contain no double A's, a repetition in which I sense, confusedly, the presence of another history and mindset. A plug socket, a bathroom tap, a jam jar, or an airport sign may tell us more than its designer intended. It may speak of the nation that made it. And the nation that made the sign at Schiphol Airport seems very far from my own. A bold archaeologist of national character might trace the influence of the lettering back to the distill movement of the early 20th century. The prominence of the English subtitles to the Dutch openness towards foreign influences and the foundation of the East India Company in 1602. And the overall simplicity of the sign to the Calvinist aesthetic that became part of Holland's identity during the war between the United Provinces and Spain in the 16th century. That a sign could evolve so differently in two places is evidence of a simple but pleasing idea. Countries are diverse and practices variable across borders. Yet difference alone wouldn't be enough to elicit pleasure, or not for long. The difference has to seem like an improvement on what my own country is capable of. If I call the Schiphol sign exotic, it's because it succeeds in suggesting, vaguely but intensely, that the country that made it and that lies beyond the Oetgang may, in critical ways, prove more congenial than my own to my temperament and concerns. The sign is a promise of happiness.
The Woman in the Mirror, written and read by Sarah Boland.
I woke up this morning. Did not feel alive. Everything was quiet and still. No sound. No feeling. Gazing into an old woman's reflection in the mirror, I see someone I don't recognize. What happened to those hopeful eyes, that airy smile, those dreams, those thoughts? What happened to me? What happened to me, buried under loads of washing, prepared meals and mountains of discarded nappies? A life spent thinking about others and waiting for it all to begin. Filling my days and minutes with babies' cries, teenage tears and lost moments, I waited for my life to start. But it didn't. So, I just take another drink and ask the bottom of the whiskey bottle, when do I get my turn? And in the drunken haze, I catch a glimpse of that young girl again, laughing and free with hundreds of choices laid out before her. If only she followed her head instead of her heart and stopped. Stopped to analyse, assess, and articulate the moment when everything would change forever. Life got in the way. And I stopped thinking. And dreaming. Found myself at the end of a bottle. Perhaps that is why I don't recognize the woman in the mirror.
Crocky Walk by Roald Dahl. Read by Ed Ward.
No animal is half so vile as Crocky Walk, the crocodile. On Saturdays he likes to crunch 6 juicy children for his lunch, and he especially enjoys just 3 of each, 3 girls and 3 boys. He smears the boys to make them hot with mustard from the mustard pot. But mustard doesn't go with girls. It tastes all wrong with plaits and curls. With them what goes extremely well is butterscotch and caramel. It's such a super marvellous treat when boys are hot and girls are sweet. At least, that's Crocky's point of view. He ought to know. He's had a few. That's all for now. It's time for bed. Lie down and rest your sleepy head. Shh. Listen. What is that I hear? Galumphing softly up the stair. Go lock the door and fetch my gun. Go on, child. Hurry, quickly, run. Oh, no. Stop. Stand back. Oh, he's coming in. Oh, look, that greasy, greenish skin, the shining teeth, the greedy smile. It's Crocky Walk, the crocodile.
An extract from Dan Leno and the Limehouse Golem by Peter Ackroyd, read by Linda Taylor.
The theatre was so brightly lit that I might have been watching it in a dream,
All the gas lights flared around me, and in the brightness my mother's coat looked so faded and threadbare that I would gladly have exchanged it for any piece of outlandish stage gear. There was a small crowd outside, wondering at a poster. There must have been flower girls and cab touts and hawkers and such trades, and one boy was spelling it out for his father. "It's Jenny Hill," he said as I joined them, "the vital spark, and then there's Tommy Move Over for Your Uncle Far. He dances with a skipping rope." His father shook his head with immense satisfaction. "And then it turns into a hangman's piece of cord. But where's that tiny one with the clogs?" He was there, billed on this night as the infant Lino, the whippersnapper with a million faces and a million laughs, every song funny, every song in character. I could no more have prevented myself from walking towards the lights than I could have stopped breathing. All thoughts of my mother disappeared as I took my ticket and went up to the gods. This was where I belonged, with the golden angels all around me. The dancing Quakers came on first, with a shuffle routine, and some peel was thrown at them from the pit. Then there were a couple of swagger songs from a Lyons comique, a pair of patterers called the Nurse who did some encores and obliging is again, until Dan Leno made his appearance. He was dressed as a dairy girl, complete with a little apron and bonnet frilled in blue, and he danced his way across the stage with a milk pail on either arm. There was a lovely picture of the Strand behind him once again, and this time I managed to pick out some of the signs and shop windows, which were much more glorious here than they were in reality. In my old life, I'd seen things darkly, but now they were most clear and brilliant. Even the dust on the stage seemed to shine, and the painted green door at the corner of Villiers Street seemed so inviting that I wanted to knock and walk in.
Princess Marjorie Moore, written and read by Vicky Parsons.
"Oh, Pompous, I'm so glad you're here," Princess Marjorie Moore cried when he entered the throne room, breaking into a huge smile.
"And what exactly is it Princess Marjorie Moore wants?"
Pompous asked stiffly. He didn't like people that smiled. What were they so happy about?
"Oh, nothing. I'm just bored."
"Bored? You're bored?"
Pompous was incredulous. Was this not what she wanted? Not what she had wished for? They were fulfilling her heart's desire. She was the princess of a magnificent kingdom, and yet she was bored. Princess Marjorie Moore, or Marjorie to us, was a little scared of Pompous, but soldiered on anyway.
"Well, no, it's not that I'm ungrateful. It's just there doesn't seem to be a TV anywhere. At least, I can't find one."
"A what?"
Pompous had no idea what she was talking about.
"You know, a TV, a television."
But Pompous was just looking at her blankly.
"Don't you know what a television is?"
So now she was mocking him. Pompous hated the way all these stupid princesses would come into his castle and look down on him, as though they were so much better because they lived in the real world.
"I'm very sorry, Your Highness, but no, I do not know what a television is. Perhaps Your Highness should have made a wish to be surrounded by these television creatures, rather than a beautiful castle with servants that are boring."
"Oh, no, Pompous, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply. I just never met anyone that doesn't know what a television is before, that's all."
"Well, I've never met anyone that does know what a television is, so perhaps you're the ignorant one."
"Yes, perhaps." Marjorie was beginning to feel a bit stupid. "So, what do you guys do for entertainment round here, then?"
"Entertainment? Entertainment?"
Pompous wished he didn't have to tell her. But of course his wishes never came true, did they? Only stupid, spoilt children got their wishes fulfilled. So, with as much spite as he could possibly muster, he spat,
"Jesters." Ooh, jesters! She clapped her hands together in delight. Of course, court jesters! Margery had never seen a jester before, and if she waited for Pompous to offer, she'd never get to see one at all. So with as much regal authority as she could muster, Margery said, "Well, I'd like to see a jester then, please." To this, Pompous would have liked to have shouted, "Well, you can't, so na-na-na-na-na." But of course he couldn't. So instead, he simply sniffed. "If you must." And being unable to stomach her gloats, he sulked his way out of the room. But Margery was not in the least bit bothered. She was going to see a jester and finally meet somebody happy. Because jesters had to be happy, didn't they? That was their job.
Overheard on a Salt Marsh by Harold Munro. Read by Zoe Behag.
Nymph, nymph, what are your beads? Green glass goblin? Why do you stare at them? Give them me. No. Give them me, give them me. No. Then I will howl all night in the reeds, lie in the mud and howl for them. Goblin, why do you love them so? They are better than stars or water, better than voices of winds that sing, better than any man's fair daughter, your green glass beads on a silver ring. Hush! I stole them out of the moon. Give me your beads, I want them. No! I will howl in the deep lagoon for your green glass beads. I love them so. Give them me, give them. No.
The Taste of Dark Chocolate. Written and read by Felicia Schremel.
At 2:15 p.m. on the 17th of August 1962, 18-year-old Peter Fechter jumps out of the window of a carpenter's shop in the Mitte district of Berlin, climbs over a barbed wire fence and runs across a strip of land, 60 meters wide, towards the wall that parts east and west. 10 seconds later, Rolf Fischer, a 23-year-old border guard, looks down from his watchtower, recognizes the situation, and empowered by a sensation of duty, starts shooting, hastily, struggling to aim. When the first shot sounds, Peter Fechter freezes for a second, losing his focus, standing motionless in the middle of the death strip. Then he starts running, ignoring the hail of bullets around him and jumps up the wall, struggling to hold onto the brickwork. At this moment, the young border guard aims at his object and shoots. Bullets 34 and 35 hit Peter Fechter in back and stomach. He falls 2 meters to the ground and collapses, slowly bleeding to death over the course of an hour in front of a watching crowd on either side of the same city. No one dares to pull him across. They stand in shock, confused, and puzzled by the reality of what this regime is doing to its people. 20 years later, I'm holding my mum's hand as we're walking down an aisle in a barely stocked supermarket on the hunt for a bar of chocolate in the country that runs out of bananas and oranges over weeks, but whose bullet supply never ceases. I remember how I wanted to wear this bright yellow baseball cap that day, a freebie from a West German TV station that had somehow smuggled itself into my room. Mum said this would be like walking down the street waving a flag declaring what dissidents we were, what nonconformists. She had a point. The communist fashion at the time was dull, to say the least. Uniformly produced shades of grey and green and a ghastly orange. The theory was simple. Bright colours might provoke enlightened minds, the last thing this state wanted. At the age of 18, Peter Fechter made his run for freedom, and I wasn't even born. Yet his choice of liberty over confinement, free speech over censorship, open minds over a regime of thought police, his belief in all or nothing at all might just be the reason why we're here now. And what remains are the taste of dark chocolate and a dull sensation that no one can be trusted.
An extract from The Five People You Meet in Heaven by Mitch Albom, read by Rebecca Falick.
Eddie felt his feet touch ground. The sky had changed again, from cobalt blue to a charcoal grey, and Eddie was surrounded now by fallen trees and blackened rubble. He grabbed his arms, shoulders, thighs and calves. He felt stronger than before, but when he tried to touch his toes, he could no longer do so. The limberness was gone. No more childish, rubbery sensation. Every muscle he had was as tight as piano wire. He looked around at the lifeless terrain. On a nearby hill lay a busted wagon and the rotting bones of an animal. Eddie felt a hot wind whip across his face. Then the sky exploded to a flaming yellow. And once again Eddie ran. He ran differently now, in the hard, measured steps of a soldier. He heard thunder, or something like thunder, explosions or bomb blasts, and he instinctively fell to the ground, landed on his stomach, and pulled himself along by his forearms. The sky burst open and gushed rain, a thick, brownish downpour. Eddie lowered his head and pulled along in the mud. He did this for a long time, spitting out the dirty water that gathered around his lips. Finally, he felt his head brush against something solid. He looked up to see a rifle, dug into the ground, with a helmet sitting atop it and a set of dog tags hanging from the barrel. He reached up and, blinking through the rain shower, fingered the dog tags, then let go as if he'd been bitten. He scrambled backward until he bumped into something else, a porous wall of thick, stringy vines hanging from a massive banyan tree. He dove through the vines and fell into their darkness. He pulled his knees into a tight crouch and wiped water from his face, trying to catch his breath. Fear had found him, even in heaven. The name on the dog tags was his.
The Neglected Wife's Valentine by Pam Ayres, read by Caroline Heyer.
Won't someone send me a valentine to make my husband jealous? Something big and gaudy, altogether overzealous. Write upon it, Pam, my heart stands still when you walk past. And when my husband sees it, he might notice me at last. Oh, write me something torrid, like I'm burning with desire. Meet me in mustique before me underclothes catch fire. My husband will be staggered. He will read it like a book. And think, well, someone fancies her. I'll have another look. Go on, write me something saucy so my husband will be miffed. Like, you won't need your pyjamas, if you kind of get me drift. I'll leave it on the mantelpiece. And when he rushes through, he'll read it. And then next year, he might think to send one too.
Egg Time. Written and read by Ian Warren.
Time's based on paranoia. That's a funny thing about time. Imagine for a minute that you're in the kitchen timing your bog-standard boiled egg. 3 minutes, right? Not a second more and not a second less. And it's important that you don't start timing until the first bubble bursts. And boil the water slowly to start, with the egg in from the very beginning, or it'll crack, and no one wants a cracked egg, right? So the first bubble bursts, and you look up at the clock on the wall. The water's boiling, you look at the second hand. It's at 12 seconds past the 12. OK, slightly inconvenient, but so be it. 12 seconds past the 12. 12 seconds past, I must remember 12 seconds. The water boils and you watch the second hand. It passes the 12, but it's 12 seconds past the 12 that you're looking out for. 12 seconds past the 12, remember, 12 seconds. That's it, 1 minute gone. The water's boiling violently now, leaping out over the top of the pan. Loud hisses as it makes contact with the burning ring. You think about turning the heat down, just a touch, you understand, but your eyes are fixed on the movement of the second hand and you dare not risk looking away. 12 seconds past 12. 12 seconds past. 12 seconds. 12. 12. 12. No. Oh, no. The second hand stopped. It stopped! No, no, wait. No, it hasn't. It was just an extra long second. Visions of your soldier bending instead of sinking into the clinging yellow. The second hand passes the 12, but it's 2 seconds past the 2 you're waiting for. Or 7 seconds past the 1. They're both the same as 12 seconds past the 12. Oh my God, why am I obsessing about these 12 seconds? That's it, 2 minutes down. Or was that the first minute? No, it can't be. No, it's the second minute. Yeah, definitely. The second minute. That's the second time it's reached 12 seconds past the 12. No, wait. Now it's on the 6. That was quick. Perhaps that was 3 minutes. Was it 2 minutes or 3 minutes? Shit! If it was 3 minutes, I'm going to have a hard yolk. Oh, shall I take the pan off, stop the boiling? Ah, sod it. If it's past 3 minutes, it's hard anyway. Besides, I'm sure that was only 2 minutes. All of this fretting and anguish, and suddenly, just as you're getting on top of the situation, the time's up. If indeed that was 3 minutes, then God forbid not 4. Quick now, pan off the heat. Get the egg out and open the top ASAP, otherwise it'll continue to cook and you don't want a hard yolk. In the egg cup. Lovely. Shit. You forgot to do your soldiers during the 3 minutes. You can't have dippy egg without soldiers. Shit! So what's this guy's egg obsession, you may well ask? Actually, I don't give a monkey's about eggs. It's just the whole egg boiling scenario is more or less the same dilemma you experience every decade from the age of 30, and this I do give a monkey's about. 30. The big 3-0. 30. Or am I 20? 30's only one decade past the 10, or is it? No shit, it's two decades past. 30! Middle-aged? No, not yet. What's the problem? I've got loads of time. Blimey, I mean, in another 30 years, I'll only be 60. And even that's not that old, really, is it? Nowadays, you're still active at 60, aren't you? What's that? 40? But that flew by. But not to worry, because only yesterday I was reading that 40's a new 30. And let's not forget that life begins at 40. Hang on. If life begins at 40 and 40's a new 30, I've got to wait another 10 years for my life to start, and then I'll be 50. 40 years past the 10 never can't be 50. That's 38 years past the 12, which was 1 year before 13. Ah, the teenage years. What were they like? I can't remember. No, this can't be happening. 50, fuck. Now things are getting really serious. Grey receding hair and sensible conversations about government policy on the elderly, which of course you're not. No, not yet. You're only 50, for God's sake. Bloody hell, you'll probably live until 100. That means you're only halfway through boiling your egg. Thank God. Mind you, what's the point of life beyond 70? I mean, by then you're really hard-boiled. Your soldier's not going to be dipping into any soft yolks then. Oh no, bloody hell, 70! What happened to 60? I seem to have skipped 10 years. I thought life was supposed to slow down as you get older, and I've just lost 10 more fucking years. The second hand hasn't stopped, it's speeded up, the bastard. It's here, 70, shit! You forgot to get married and have kids. You can't go through life without getting married and having kids, shit! Quick, I need my time again. I'm beyond hard-boiled, I'm fucking solid. The water's boiling now around my ears, and now far from wanting to see the second hand pass again, I want out. I want to escape from this burning hell and be cracked by the back of a cold spoon. I want to feel the relief oozing from the top of my head. There's all sorts of pressures now, pounding at my head. Fuck me, 90! I'm surprised I can still count. Still, nothing much else to do. I remember thinking how I might live to 100. Bollocks to that now. Please, can any of you hear me? Turn the bloody machine off. It's boiling in here. I'm burning up. For crying out loud, I'm done! Makes you wonder, don't it? It's cold today. Going to rain tomorrow, apparently. Still, it's good for the garden. Boiled egg, anyone?